Well, I think I'll get us started this afternoon. My name is Chris Manfredi. I'm the Provost and Vice Principal Academic of McGill University. I'm very pleased to see my predecessor, Tony Massey, in the audience. It's a tough job following him, but so far 3 months, I don't think I've misstepped yet, but I'm sure I will at some point. Anyway, it's my pleasure to welcome all of you to the opening of the Trache Public Science Symposium. It's been a tradition to open the symposium with a round table. This is the first time that the round table has been open to the public. We're very pleased that we're doing that this year. It's going to be a fascinating discussion. The topic of the symposium this year is a question of evidence on GMOs, cell phones, and vaccines. And we've got a great distinguished panel of internal McGill people and people from outside of McGill, who I'm sure will be led quite ably by Dr. Joe Schwartz. And they are going to engage us in a fascinating discussion on evidence. So having said that, I'll turn the floor over to Joe and welcome you all again. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. The first thing to do is to quickly introduce everyone. I'm not going to spend much time on this because we have a lot of things to discuss, but we will go around and introduce everyone. Dr. Terry Polovoy at the end is a pediatrician, but his real interest is in fighting pseudoscience, and he's got a website that does that very, very well. Ariel Fenster is my colleague here at McGill in the Office for Science Society. Dr. Bruce Lennox is the Dean of Science. Andre Picard is one of Canada's most noted journalists. He writes for the Globe and Mail. Missing here is Julie Payette, who's a Canadian astronaut, and I suspect that she may be tied up because of the story of the water on Mars. Not that she's going there, but Dr. Brian Ward, another colleague from McGill, he is one of our speakers tonight on vaccination, immunologist. Dr. Kevin Folta here is another speaker. He'll be speaking tomorrow night. He's from the University of Florida, and his expertise is horticulture, and he'll be addressing the issue of genetic modified organisms. Dr. Paul Offit from Philadelphia Children's Hospital and University of Pennsylvania is a world's expert on vaccination. Written a number of books, and is a lightning rod for the anti-vaccine people. Right? Dr. Jeffrey Kabat is from New York City, from the Albert Einstein School of Medicine at Shiva. He's an epidemiologist, and he does a lot of work on cancer, and he'll be addressing the public tomorrow, talking about radiation risks from cell phones. Lauren Trache, of course, who is the sponsor of the whole symposium. By background, he's an electrical engineer and interested in every possible aspect of science. Bill Brownstein is a columnist with the Montreal Gazette and likes to muckrake, and there's a lot of muck to be raked. Dr. Aaron Rosen is a first-year resident in ophthalmology, but that's not why he's here. He's actually here to bring down the average age. Aaron, we've been corresponding with Aaron and collaborating with him throughout his medical school career because he's organized a number of meetings to highlight the pseudoscience that is going on and how medical students should fight it. Dr. Kenneth Foster also comes from Philadelphia, where he's a professor of engineering with a main interest in electromagnetic radiation. And Dr. Christopher Labels is another McGill graduate. He's a cardiologist, but he has seen the light and loves to interact with the media and writes regularly. He blogs, also writes for the Montreal Gazette, and also has a podcast called The Body of Evidence. And there's going to be a live recording of that podcast tomorrow at noon in the Centre Mont-Royal. So that's our panel. And the idea here is to have kind of a free-roaming discussion about the issues that you have in front of you. And I think we will wander. You know, we don't necessarily have to stick to everything. There are some interesting issues that came up just yesterday and today that I think may be interesting to address, and Kevin will talk about that. But I think it would be good to start with the first question that we did list here, because after all, this symposium is called Question of Evidence. So we should somehow have a look at just what we think evidence is, because it's it means different things to different people. So maybe we can start with that and go around the table and see just, you know, what people think evidence is. And maybe we'll start with Chris at that end.
Well, I think the most interesting thing, and I think the thing most people don't understand, is that there's different levels of evidence. You can, you know, different committees have different criteria, but you have at one end of the spectrum, you have randomized trials or meta-analyses of randomized trials, which provide very good evidence. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you have observational trials or case reports, which provide weaker degrees of evidence. And so, you know, the public seems to think that if there was a study published in a journal somewhere, then, well, that must be true. But of course, that's not necessarily the case. Studies do disprove prior studies, and we have to understand that not all studies are created equal, and not all scientific researchers approach their studies with the same degree of rigor. So we talk about evidence as if it's one thing without realizing that there really should be a sliding scale to this entire discussion.
I guess the question is, who is you're asking this about? A layperson might respond by looking at statements by health agencies and doctor's statements about reliable judgments about issues. I personally am on a committee that sets limits for human exposure to radio waves, and our committee looks at everything that's published and tries to sift through the papers according to quality, and we're looking at a very different answer to your question than a layperson would who's trying to answer their own personal questions about their personal health.
Aaron?
You know, I think I'll talk about, you know, my experience in terms of, you know, dealing with this in terms of just, you know, patient care and, you know, and my little experience so far. You know, I think in terms of open interpretation, you know, having evidence being open to interpretation is I think in itself maybe a misnomer. It's being educated about how to interpret evidence. I think we have to start with having our children in schools, you know, learning and learning how to interpret evidence, learning how to be science-based, science-focused. And I think if we can do that, it kind of goes down the rungs, and eventually we have this open to interpretation being the fact that we don't have to constantly having experts, you know, speaking. We have every, you know, every human being in society actually understanding what evidence is and how we can interpret it that way. I think that's to a degree how we have to approach it. It has to start with society, and then from there, I think we work up to evidence.
Bill, we'll get a different perspective from you, because when you write, what you have to do is seek out evidence and know who to seek it out from.
And it's very dangerous. It's very easy in the case of our friend Paul Offit, because he's right all the time. But for the most part, it's for a layperson, it's very, very confusing. We get studies all the time. Cell phones are dangerous. Cell phones aren't dangerous. GMOs are dangerous. They're not dangerous. Caffeine is good, caffeine is bad. And so we take whatever is in the zeitgeist at the moment and we run with that because it's sexy, whatever it is, chocolate is good, chocolate is not good. And I mean, we don't know, and the public doesn't know. We just know what we want to hear. So we'd like to hear that wine is good, maybe, and coffee is good, maybe certain things aren't good, but there's such a confusion, and the problem is us, I mean, to a large extent, the media, because we report basically on what we think will sell and what we think is sexy, and it's dangerous, and I don't think the public has a clue.
Lauren.
Yeah, well, to pick up from what Bill was just saying, I mean, I've been a science geek all my life, and I value science immensely, but one of the disturbing facts about science. We had a panelist here a couple of years ago, Johnny Ioannidis, and he his work says, you know, like about 90% of what's published, at least as preliminary science results, turns out to be wrong in the end. And so that's an important message that people need to understand, is that you don't jump to conclusions. To really prove something in science is really hard and takes a long time, and most of what gets published turns out to be wrong. And it's part of the process that people need to understand that.
Jeffrey?
Going back to what Chris said, it's even more complicated because we all teach that there's a hierarchy of evidence, randomized clinical trials, cohort studies, case control studies, individual case reports, and cross-sectional studies. In fact, depending on the question that you're interested in, a clinical trial may not be able to answer the question. You're interested in a harmful exposure or something at a certain low level. Or if you get the dose wrong or the window of exposure wrong in your clinical trial, you're going to get the wrong answer. And so depending on what the question is, depending on what the exposure is, case control studies, which I know I've done them, have their limitations, they can actually be very informative. And one example that springs to mind is that case control studies gave the first signal about smoking and lung cancer, and smoking and cancer of the mouth and so forth. So these are all tools. The problem is to assess the totality of the evidence, looking at it critically and looking at how it fits together and what it ultimately has to say. And that's hard to do, and there are all these other things that impinge. People's desire to find an interesting result, or people's desire to protect the public from, you know, trace levels of this or that chemical. And there are all these other things that get mixed in with interpreting the evidence. So it's a problem.
Paul.
Yeah, I'm going to pick up on what Lawrence said. I think what he said is exactly right. Good evidence requires patience, and I think we're not very patient. So, for example, when Andrew Wakefield raised the hypothesis that the combination of measles, mumps, rubella vaccine caused autism, it took time to figure that out. I mean, and so there were different studies done by different groups of investigators on different continents using different populations of people, and over time a truth emerged. I mean, as there were 5 studies and 10 studies, and now close to 20 studies that have looked at that and all said the same thing. I think a truth has emerged. I mean, it hasn't. Donald Trump hasn't found out about it yet, but for the most part, most people now see that Wakefield was wrong. But you had to be patient. And once that issue was raised, it did a lot of harm because, you know, we had to wait to really until the evidence was in.
Kevin.
Yeah, I think about a quotation from Carl Sagan that was, "I don't want to believe, I want to know." And in order for me to know, and in order for me to reach the truth with a capital T, I need to be a connoisseur of evidence, and not just but paying attention to all evidence and being open to all evidence. Being open to even things that may be from groups with some credulous past or maybe some curious alternative motives, but still paying attention to what they're saying and weighing it carefully. In popular culture, we see that evidence means, well, my sister's yoga teacher said. And I think it really needs to be, we need to elevate scientifically what that definition of evidence is and make our society better connoisseurs of science. And maybe the best way to do that is for people to challenge themselves with taking the evidence that has been presented and seeing how it articulates with the rest of the evidence that's out there. How does it make a more complex picture? How does it fit or not fit with what we already know? So for me, evidence is just another piece of the bigger puzzle. And good evidence usually will find a way to articulate and grow from that spot.
Right.
I've lived for a long time with a particularly obnoxious brother who's been passionate about open access journals. And so every time I publish in a non-open access journal, he points it out to me in no uncertain terms. He's now president of the PLOS board, and he has become no less obnoxious. What I think is difficult for us to deal with is that the nature of academic evidence is changing quite dramatically with the hundreds of new journals. I mean, I think probably most of us sitting around the table receive petitions from journals every day.
Thousands.
And so it used to be that evidence from an academic point of view was that it had been published. But now there's a huge amount of evidence in those old terms that's absolutely worthless. And I think that it's very difficult for us to adapt to that new world of publishing science.
Andre.
I think there's quite a chasm between what scientists think evidence is and what a large part of the public thinks it is. I think for the public, evidence is what someone you trust tells you, whether it's Dr. Oz or your neighbor over the fence. So evidence is often anecdote. My aunt has cancer. She went on a grapefruit diet. She's better now. Therefore, grapefruits cure cancer. That's evidence for a large part of the public. And that is evidence because we are largely a scientifically illiterate society. But I think scientists have to try and bridge that gap by explaining a little simpler, not use terms like RCT, which means nothing to people, and try and explain a little better why you have to be patient and why things aren't always clear and why Dr. Oz isn't always right.
Wait, Dr. Oz isn't always right?
Yes, you heard it here first.
Following on Brian's comment, I think that we have a credibility problem in the way the information is also being transmitted. And I did an experiment. I'm an experimentalist, but I did an experiment in the classroom about 20 years ago, and I've continued it, and it's continued to be that students tell me it's the hardest thing they've ever done. Is I asked them to translate into 250 words so it could be published in the Globe and Mail. A paper from Nature Science on a topic that we're learning. The first time they do this, they always get three assignments in a term. The first time, it's unbelievably difficult for them. And they can translate into any language they want, as long as I can understand it. I think we have the wrong people translating the science that's getting into the public. I think that the creators of the... I think we as scientists are responsible for translating this into terminology and in a manner that the public and the press can actually consume, because I think a huge part of the problem is the translators are simply, it's completely unreasonable to expect them to be able to do it properly, to read the papers, to read the experimental, to look at the data. We should translate our own work. Every time we publish something, we should prepare a summary for the public.
I think really the issue is that the public doesn't have the tools to evaluate the evidence, a bit much what has been said before. I mean, there is all this terminology, studies, clinical study, epidemiological study, but most people don't know what it is in the general public. And this is one thing I do with my student. I spend some time actually explaining what the different studies are. Because if you look at the press, usually it is a study has shown. What study? How was it carried out? Under what condition? I think this is where, as scientists, we have a role to play to really explain what this term actually means.
I'm a practicing physician, soon to be retired. I'm not an academic. And I've gone through changes in my life personally where I focus on quackery. And when a patient comes in, they're always bringing in, a typical thing would be Dr. Google. And there's no evidence in Dr. Google unless it's published in a peer-reviewed journal. And you try and explain to them what that is. But it comes from a journal. They hold up the journal. And that's kind of hard to do. And the media, especially the mass media, has a responsibility to help educate the public. But they all want to read the sports page. Right? They don't want to read scientific studies. And not everybody subscribes to the Globe and Mail or Montreal Gazette or the New York Times, even though they're trying to sell it to you every day. The New York Times does anyway. So I think having to communicate on a one-to-one basis, I feel good after I do it. But whether the websites I have do that, I don't know. I get a lot of hate mail sometimes, but it doesn't affect me.
Well, I think the next point here is linked to what we just talked about and what Brian brought up, is this glut of publishing and you know, where does it really lead? In there are, I think, two issues here. Is one, peer review. Well, it depends on who the peers are, because, as you know, many of you know, I mean, I'm pretty vocal about homeopathy, not pro. And so I do get into discussions with the homeopaths, and of course they send me their journal articles from things like the Journal of Homeopathy, which is peer-reviewed, but the peers are homeopaths. So what do we make of that? So that's one point, who the peers are. But there's another question here, I think, and that is that not everything is worth publishing. Not every experiment that is done is worth bringing to the attention of other scientists. So that's the question is, never mind the peer review. I mean, a referee gets a paper to review, okay. But the other question is, even if this paper is fine, they did the experiment, they interpreted it properly, whatever, does it add to the body of evidence? So could that be another criterion for rejecting a paper? Not that there's anything wrong with it, not that it's fraudulent, it's just not important enough. So I think now we won't go around. We'll just, whoever wants to pipe up and go ahead. Chris.
I think one of the problems with the peer review system, the question is here, like, do we need to review the peer review system? It's absolutely, because in many circumstances, the peers who are asked to review don't have the expertise or the statistical background to actually review a clinical paper. I mean, I get asked to review papers, you know, I'm an ad hoc reviewer for a bunch of journals, and sometimes I say yes, and sometimes I can't because of my schedule, and I say no. It's actually very hard to find reviewers because it's very difficult for people to donate their time, because it really is, you're donating your time for free, and many people can't do it all the time, and many times you get whoever's available. And that person may not be a researcher, may not have a background in biostats, and may not be able to appreciate that something has been done wrong. You know, you can go through the New England Journal of Medicine, arguably the premier medical journal, and find mistakes. Like things that, and you say, how did that get published? Well, it's because the peer review system is not perfect. As to your point about all these journals, we could eliminate 95% of the medical journals out there and not suffer scientifically whatsoever. We have too many of them out there. The problem is, how do you get rid of them? I'm not sure I have a good solution for that, but yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, so there was an article published, I think, in 1981 in New England Journal of Medicine claiming that excess coffee drinking caused pancreatic cancer.
Right, yes,
so that,
yes.
that was wrong. Yeah, it's okay. I mean, because I think science stands on two pillars. The weaker of the two pillars is peer review. The stronger of the two pillars is reproducibility. Yeah. If you're right, time will prove you're right, and if you're not, it won't. So I think I don't think we would ever, frankly, be able to effectively regulate the peer review system because it's flawed. I mean, the Andrew Wakefield paper claiming that MMR caused autism, that was in The Lancet. You know, it's the oldest of the general medical journals. That was peer reviewed by peers, by people, colleagues who understood that those data. Still, it was published. So I am choosing to count on reproducibility to show whether things are true or not.
The problem with reproducibility, though, is that people don't like they don't like reproducing research because it's not as sexy, right? It's not as likely to get published. And you see, you have one study once, and then you try to submit sort of a similar project, or an independent group has to submit a similar project, say, well, it's not novel anymore.
But if it's not, if it's a bold claim that's incorrect,
claim,
then it fails over. I mean, the MMR story is certainly that. I mean, there's that Gary Taubes book, Bad Science, looking at cold fusion. I mean, that was a novel claim that obviously couldn't stand the test of time.
Okay. Peer review is useless, but I think it's hopeless to rail against peer review, given the fact that there are several thousand new journals, some of whom offer a one-week cycle between when a paper is submitted and when it's peer-reviewed and published. If I submit a paper to The Lancet and it gets turned down, I could submit it to the Montreal Gazette, and if they turn it down, I could submit it to someone else, and eventually it's going to get published. So there's got to be some other mechanism other than peer review to act as a filter to help integrate this knowledge. And it's got to be something other than peer review.
Lauren.
Yeah, I would say that one of the things that's lacking here is to educate the public in general about, you know, how to interpret all these different science findings that keep coming out all the time, and to try to educate the public that there's a big hurdle between, you know, something that gets published and something that is generally accepted by scientists, and what's that process. And like Paul mentioned, you know, reproducibility is a key criteria. And I think there's a big job to be done to educate the public that they need to have a much higher bar before they start taking any of these sort of preliminary findings seriously.
Well, what about the issue of rejecting a paper just because it doesn't add enough to the body of knowledge. And I think that the reason that that doesn't happen is because reviewers also think, gee, you know, someone's going to do that to me if I...
I guess I have to write a letter that accompanies every manuscript I submit. And in that letter, I have to justify why it fits in that journal and why it's worthy of publication. And so maybe that's a level where you could filter this. I have to talk about why it's... But then again, I don't publish... I publish in journals that have some impact. I try to publish in journals with some impact. So it's trying to fit them into better places. And maybe that's the trick, is redefining what we call a... You know, maybe legitimizing a certain suite of journals that allow them to rise up above the large number of more predatory ones that are now out there.
I was speaking to a friend of mine who's a medical librarian down in Boston, and he had the greatest line about the medical journal system ever. He said, it's a crazy system if you think about it, because we produce the research, we give it to them for free, and then they sell it back to us. And one of the big issues now with medical information is that it's actually very expensive to get access to these journals. Like when you work in a university, you get access to it from your university affiliation. But this has become increasingly burdensome. And there is something very odd about the entire system where we're relying on medical journals. You know, 100 years ago, there was a justification for medical journals. They disseminated the information. There is an argument to be made to say that they don't serve the same purpose anymore now, and you could just as easily have every university filter its own research, and then you could have much tighter controls because the people reviewing your work are actually your peers. They're there. They're looking at you. You have to justify it to people that you have to look at in the eye. So, you know, we have to rethink how medical journals work because they were designed for an age that no longer really exists.
What does the Dean of Science say about that, internal peer review?
Well, I think we all do that. I think we do at a university like McGill. I think our colleagues do, in fact, do that. Their peers can also be their PhD students and their postdocs. I mean, I don't think any paper in the Faculty of Science goes from you know, the Word version out to a journal with no one in the outside world seeing it. So... you know, we've talked about predatory journals, and they are. There's also a huge, huge problem. I'm a chemist in the chemistry field, of the incentives applied to people's careers outside of our type of university. There are countries where people's pay is related to how many papers they submit. It's just very, very blunt. And you know, I have reviewed sometimes the same paper or seen the same paper three or four times. I reject it, goes to another journal, it comes back to me, I tell the editor, I saw this, I rejected it, here's my previous review. 3 weeks later, I'll get it again. And then finally, somebody figures it out and they send it to, you know, a fifth journal that I'm not going to be a reviewer of. So I don't see a solution to that except that we apply our own standards. There's not a week I don't go into my lab and say, look at this piece of junk, you know, read this paper, but this is terrible on a field related to what we're working on. And that's not in a grade Z journal. That might be in a good journal.
Well, Julie, as a peer, we figured you were tied up with water on Mars.
I was, actually.
So what's the latest? It's
well,
there?
Many of you probably, hi everybody, hello, I'm very sorry, there's that, and then there's the Montreal construction going on. We, the scientists who are interested in this particular topic, knew for a long time that there was very strong evidence that there had been flowing water on Mars, and there was still some flowing water of sort, but certainly something hydrated. Flowing at times, and now we just have very concrete evidence. So that means it can be scrutinized by anybody and looked at independently, which is science, yeah?
Yeah, that fits very nicely with the evidence.
So now we know for sure.
I rejected that paper.
Are they going to make vodka out of it now, or what?
It depends if you like your vodka salted. It's more martini, I think. I don't drink martinis.
Okay, we've just been chatting about what evidence is, and, and the
that's part of it.
Yeah, the glut of publications, and that people get confused. You know, another thing that you know, the general public thinks about peer review is that the peers actually repeat the experiments. they think that it's a, it's such a, you know, in-depth review. But, I mean, obviously, the only thing that you can review is what it says was done. And if someone is going to be fraudulent about it, like Andrew Wakefield, I mean, the referees are not going to pick that up. So, you know, we get this all the time is, well, you know, it was published in peer-reviewed journal. It must be so. Well, if someone is overtly fraudulent, that is going to go through, as long as it sounds reasonable. Aaron.
I think also to a certain degree, we have to also evaluate the fact that, you know, today, publishing in a journal is a race. You know, we have to, you know, it's making the research, getting it done as fast as possible to be able to publish in the highest impact journal as fast as possible. And I think, you know, also touching on what Dr. Labos also just described, you know, our angle should be good science, not necessarily publishing it in a paper. And I think, you know, we have a lot of great scientists, but maybe perhaps to reevaluate the fact and try to, in fact, make that our end goal, not just the publication.
And Joe, I think to me, I agree with a lot of the panelists. It's hard to control that. There's going to be all kinds of stuff published. What I'm more interested in is how does it filter up to the public? So there's about 8,000 scientific papers published today. How many get into the mainstream media? Maybe a dozen. And I think that's more. We should pay more attention to that. What's getting to the public and why? I often say that in my business, in journalism, the most important thing is not what we write, it's what we don't write. And we don't do enough of that filtering either. And so I think there has to be more work on that and on the middleman, if you will, the universities, what do they choose to publicize? There's a lot of politics in that. And it's not necessarily the best science that's getting out there. And, you know, journalists, let's be realistic, they're not going to read 8,000 articles a day. They're going to read the stuff that's promoted by the big journals and by the universities and by hospitals. And who's making those decisions and why? And, you know, is that really what the public needs to know?
Well, that actually leads into the next topic here, and that is the role of the social media and how that has just taken over, and that this is where people are getting their information. You know, when you see that the Food Babe, with no scientific expertise, has over 5 million followers, and what do even, you know, scientists who are popular bloggers get? I mean, nothing close to that. So this is a question that has to be raised, is what do we do in the face of all of this inexpertise that is out there that presents itself as if it were expertise?
That's frightening. As disreputable as the mass media can be, this is even more confusing because there, again, you've got people read Twitter, they read blogs, they have no idea. Someone can say there's something, you mentioned the Food Babe, for example, is something there. We have no clue. People have no clue who these people are, but again, it's writing things that grasp the imagination, and now, I mean, we're just overwhelmed with information. Most of it not scientific. I mean, Dr. Oz is looking good compared to some of the blogs that come out of there. Seriously, this is frightening. And this misinformation that gets out, someone pointed out my sister's yoga teacher says something or other. That's exactly what's happening. And then it spreads and becomes part of the mythology, and then in perception becomes reality. It's scarier now than it's ever been.
But I think we're fighting back. I mean, you know, groups like science-based medicine or left brain, right brain, or science of the people, or what you do. I mean, and what you do, Joe. I mean, I think we have engaged that form of media to try and get good information out there. I guess what we have to do is try and be as interesting, if not more interesting, than they are. I mean, we have to make sure we frame our science in an emotional and compelling way to make it just as interesting as they are. I mean, the reason Dr. Oz sells so well is because he tells you what you want to hear. Here's a way to magically melt off those pounds. Here's a way to have thicker hair, better sex, whatever. I mean, that, you know, you do a great job at trying not getting better sex or thicker hair, but you could do that if you try.
How do you know?
That I run a science center, and clearly we're not going to be imparting all knowledge and everything all the time to everybody, and we don't pretend ever to even get near there. What we really focus on is to give people tools to ask questions, to use their minds, to use their sense of analysis and their critical thinking, because that's where it makes the difference. It doesn't matter. The information is out there, and a good one is there also. yesterday was a good example. Yesterday was a beautiful lunar eclipse, as you know, for a full moon and a full eclipse from our point of view in North America. And my son, my 12-year-old, asked me what was an eclipse, or lunar eclipse in particular, and I was telling him, I was telling him about the moon, and he says, well, can moons have moons? And I'm like, well, that's a good question. I don't think so, but I'm not sure. So I need you to, we're in the car, to go on the iPad and to Google, do moons have moons? And then I say, remember the three sight rules. This is a rule. I say, if you want to have an answer to a question, make sure that you consult three sites at least. And these are serious sites, not just like a blog or somebody's opinion that might not be connected to something serious. And they have to say the same thing, more or less. So if Cornell University Astronomy Club says the same thing as the Planetarium of Montreal, and then another website about do moons have moons, then we have a good chance that that makes sense. And it has to make sense. So it's about critical thinking. And that is something we don't use enough, perhaps in today's heavily communication-heavy society.
But you're appealing to a world, you're arguing for a world, and I'd like to live in that world, where you know, people are compelled by critical thinking. They're drawn to critical thinking. I'm not sure that's what Oz is appealing to, why Oz is so successful. He's so successful for the opposite reason. He doesn't want you to critically think. He wants to give you that magic medicine that's going to make it all well. That's why it's the opposite of critical thinking.
But the folks that will take that medicine are not going to go consult the scientific website either.
Right, but right? I think there's a way to, I again, naively believe there's probably a way to get to them too. I mean, you just have to make sure that they understand that, and I think for yourselves. I mean, I think people need to understand that sometimes if you do what Dr. Oz tells you to do, that you could be putting yourself in harm's way. I mean, because I think that is appealing. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think that that when Oz was brought up in front of Congress, for example, and the Kate McCaskill, was that the name? Yeah. Sort of went through, who's a former prosecutor, just went through and just nailed him. That mattered, because then what happened was you had John Oliver pick up and did, I think, the funniest 15 minutes on television ever, where he did a takedown of Ahmed Oz, because what he was doing in some ways was harmful. For yourselves, I mean, the measles, why do we care about measles all of a sudden? Why is the anti-vaccine movement taking a hit? Because there was a measles epidemic. So it's knocking at your door.
The trouble is that we don't have the sexy answers like Oz has or the food debate has, because our language has to be peppered with maybes and ifs and I don't knows. And those are terms that you will never hear uttered by the pseudoscience people. Yeah. They know everything,
yeah, so,
and they have an answer to everything.
So what you have, I mean, and this, I guess I live with this in the anti-vaccine world, what I had to do as a scientist, because I'm a basic scientist, is when I chose to try and combat the anti-vaccine movement in our country, is I had to basically do something that was very difficult for me, which was to be able to say something like, MMR vaccine doesn't cause autism, even though data would never allow me to say that, right? Because I can't prove a negative. Right. I can only say that all the data to date doesn't support the hypothesis that MMR causes autism. And the way people hear that is that they hear that there's an out in this and that it's still possible. And so you have to basically challenge the gods of science, knowing that you're doing something the scientific method doesn't allow you to do, and say something definitively, knowing you could be struck dead by the gods, the scientific method gods, which hasn't happened yet, but could.
But it could.
But there's another sense to this, too, is that we also have to be disciplined in how we respond to questions, because I don't know is a very difficult answer for most scientists, professional scientists, to say, especially if there's a microphone in front of them. And I think that we need to educate even our students that is the very best answer if that's the correct answer of I don't know. But I've heard very often people talking about things that are, they get the leading question, they bite, and then the next thing you know they're saying things that just are really shaky. So maybe we're partially responsible for some of the confusion that's out there. And then the sound bite, the 14-second sound bite in the 5-minute interview, all of a sudden bites us in the rear end. Right? So maybe we have to instill a form of discipline among ourselves as well.
Well, that's, I mean, when you're on television, I mean, you know, you have the soundbite. It's so intellectually impossible, you know, to basically take a complex issue and convert it into two or three sentences. You can't do that. You can't do it. So it's just strikes at your very heart when you know you can't do it well. You just do the best you can. It's hard.
Well, many of us here have had the experience of being interviewed for hours and hours, and it'd be squeezed down to 30 seconds. And if it's not the right 30 seconds, then you say to yourself, well, I don't want to do that again. Mm-hmm. And so that scientists shy away, whereas the bloggers and the social media people don't shy away. You know, they're out there. And I think this will now get us into the next question, which may be the most interesting one of this whole discussion, about sort of the war that now has emerged between science and pseudoscience with attacks from opponents about scientists being paid off and being in the pockets of big industry, if there's any connection that is ever made, even in some obtuse fashion. And I think the reason that this is interesting, I mean, Kevin can bring you up to date on this story because it really is an interesting one. He has been involved in sort of a tussle with this lady who calls herself the Food Babe, who gave a talk at the University of Florida where she espoused her nonsense and Kevin commented on it. And this whole thing began to steamroller, and he gets accused of being in the pockets of industry because he may have given a talk at the bequest of Monsanto researchers who said, gee, you know, we're having trouble getting our message across to the public. How should we go about, you know, communicating? And then all of a sudden, you're in their pocket, and then they start blogging and Twittering and making a lot of noise. And the reason that this became even more interesting today is because there's some activist group in Ottawa, which is against, they're probably against everything, but they're against genetic modification. And when they heard that Kevin was going to be one of our speakers, they unleashed their weaponry, saying that we have to make clear that he's actually a Monsanto shill. I mean, nonsense. And the CBC this morning actually canceled an interview where we were supposed to just talk about the symposium because they said that they didn't have enough time to check out the allegation that was made by this non-important group in Ottawa, totally irrelevant organization, but it's so easy to allege. So Kevin, maybe you want to tell your story.
Well, I can be brief. It's basically, I've been studying science for my entire life and thrilled to be a scientist. And I've also been really interested in how we communicate science to the public. And as I've moved through my academic ranks, I've always had a component that was very strong with outreach, whether it's to schools or to, I talked to the League of Women Voters, a retirement home, a third grade classroom, and an activist group all in the same week. And that's a common week. And I always enjoyed that. And in the last few years, I've really enjoyed teaching scientists how to talk about science. So all the mistakes that we talk about here, the things we don't do well. And in that regard have been spreading, kind of creating more momentum in scientists who are now adept to teach science. And that work has all been supported by donations, whether from individuals, from companies, from when I go out and do a talk and they say, you know, how much do we charge? How much do you charge for a speaker fee? I say zero. Put it to my research, my outreach program. So the outreach program has been self-sustaining and got on the radar of the Monsanto company, who said, we've got all kinds of problems with connecting to the public. Could you tell us what we're doing wrong? And I was in St. Louis anyway. They didn't pay me to go there. I was in St. Louis and went and gave my presentation. During that time, we talked about ways that I could increase the span of the outreach program. And they said, if we donated, would it be possible for you to do more of these? Sure. And I thought it was wonderful. This is exactly what companies should be doing. Is enabling us as scientists to be able to reach a larger audience. And when that became part of the discussion with activists who for years have been trying to knock me out of the public discussion, because we are changing hearts and minds. It led to an unbelievable smear campaign. If you look on Natural News, if you look across the internet, you'll see that that money went right into my pocket to lie about science. It's unbelievable, the things that have been said. And so here's a case where a science communication program, where a company provided a non-restricted, no-strings-attached grant to help scientists teach other scientists how to talk to people who are concerned about their food, turned out to be what could be, if it was other people, maybe a career-threatening takedown. Luckily, I have some momentum. I got some inertia. I've been in the business a long time, and in academic research, public research, for my entire career. Love it there. My research has nothing to do with anything Monsanto cares about. So there's always that to fall back on. But this is what happens. And the big problem is, I'll conclude with the idea that being canceled from the radio station this morning is a perfect example. The social media propagation of what has largely been a false message and a smear on a public scientist has now stopped the communication of science. And worse is it threatens other scientists' interest in integrating with a concerned public. The public needs us more than ever. They need independent voices more than ever. Yet it's the independent voices who are the ones who they're trying to stop first.
I guess when I say the word industry shill, I feel that I'm being to comment. But I guess I am. Sort of have stories somewhat similar to Kevin, except worse in the sense that, I'm the co-inventor of a vaccine. We created the bovine human reassortant strains by the late 80s in our lab that became the vaccine Rotatec. Didn't make it, didn't commercialize it from our laboratory. If you want a vaccine to be used in this world, then you go to a pharmaceutical company to do it. So we went to the pharmaceutical company Merck in the early 1990s, who then did the research. We did 10 years of the research, and then they did the research and development, which was about a 16-year, $1.2 billion effort that ultimately resulted in the vaccine Rotatec, which has been now licensed and recommended for use in our country since 2006 and in the world since 2008. So it's a good thing that we did that. There was no other option. I don't know what people, I was never paid by Merck. I was always paid by the National Institutes of Health. But I was the co-inventor of a vaccine, which meant I was a co-patent holder of a vaccine, which meant that I was a bad guy. And in the world of the anti-vaccine groups, I was really a bad guy. And so I, have gotten a lot of hate mail. I've gotten three legitimate death threats, meaning the kind that the FBI investigates, because I am, to them, the perfect storm. Now, see, I would argue that I'm a good person to talk about vaccines because I understand them. One, I made one. Two, is I understand not just the research, but also the research and development and the implementation of vaccines. So I think I'm a perfect person to comment about vaccines and how they work and how they're made. But from the anti-vaccines people's standpoint, I am the devil. And so, there have been times certainly when I've been on television shows that have gotten canceled because the anti-vaccine people have been able to get their message across. But for the most part, I've been able to hang in there. And so, I don't know. At some level, what upsets me, and I guess I ask Andre and Bill about this, I'm proud of my association with Merck because we made a vaccine that saves lives. It saves probably hundreds of lives a day. But when I'm asked to comment about any potential quote-unquote conflicts, I'm all for being transparent. I'm the co-inventor of a vaccine that was developed by Merck. But transparency has sort of morphed into bias. The minute that you're associated with a company, you're a bad guy. And that's just the way the public perceives it, although I would argue, what the hell else could I have done should I have wanted there to be a vaccine? So I don't know. It's you're damned by an association, in this case an association which produced something that was good, which is not to say that pharmaceutical companies don't act aggressively or unethically or even at times illegally. It just means that to paint them all with the same brush for all things they do all the time, I think, is sort of like this institutional racism. It's just wrong.
Now, to say that somebody's in the pocket of a pharmaceutical company has become sort of blanket statement. It doesn't even mean anything anymore. They just throw it out at you regardless of what you do. They say it to me all the time. And I say, what are you talking about? I haven't received money from a pharmaceutical company. Where are you getting this from? The goal of these groups is always to make your life so difficult that you're going to stop doing what you do, because they have an agenda. I wrote an article in the Gazette about chronic Lyme disease, and my God, the amount of hate mail I got over that. I thought I was going to get a lot when I wrote about the vaccines, and I got some, but this was incredible. speaking to a colleague of mine in BC who had also done the same type of work, and he said, Chris, this is what they do. They want to make your life so difficult that you're going to stop talking about
it.
And the worst part is that they often have a financial interest in the position that they're taking. Many of these chronic Lyme disease groups are funded by these private U.S. labs. And so they sort of throw this accusation at you, and they never look at themselves in the mirror and realize that they're directly profiting from their point of view. And it's a little bit ridiculous. And it's based on the somewhat ludicrous notion that a physician would actually wish you harm, that you have a person who, for the purposes of money, would try to sell you or tell you to do something that would purposefully make you sick, which is, I mean, not the reason why any of us got into the medical field. We got into the medical field to make people better. Why would we be trying to make people sick? It just, it fundamentally doesn't make any sense. The problem is, on social media, it doesn't have to make sense. It just has to, you know, generate a lot of likes, and then it becomes real.
It's also the zeitgeist. It's a great story, right? Yeah. I mean, it's you know, we like to believe that there's a boogeyman out there that's making our life miserable, and there it is, right? So it's the pharmaceutical industry is that. And so the minute that you can be tied to that, see, that's it. That's why we're having the Republicans are great at this, right?
Yeah.
It's the Mexicans.
Yeah.
This is currently the way it plays in the United States.
Brian, are you the devil too?
Probably. Yeah. Maybe not as bad as Paul.
In Canada, isn't the Americans? But,
no, I think that's one thing that's missing, certainly in the area of vaccines. One of the strongest arguments made by, you know, no lesser person than Robert Kennedy Jr., you know, supporting Jenny McCarthy, is that, you know, this is a mother who loves her son, and therefore she's right. There's this false causal link. And in the same breath, or in the second breath, to say that someone like Paul or myself or another person who actually has links with industry and is interested in developing new vaccines would prostitute themselves and put their own children at risk for another grant is just unbelievably hypocritical. Anyways, that's something that's missing, because I'm pretty sure that all of Paul's family members are fully vaccinated, as are my children and my dogs and everybody else. But that is a very, very powerful emotional weapon used by people in the anti-vaccine area, that we're shills, that we're bought, and that is an inevitable bias in what we do. But of course, we're in a perfect position to know if there's a conspiracy. And if there were a conspiracy, I don't think I'd be vaccinating my kids.
Although we're not allowed to talk about it.
Did Jonas Salk get this kind of scrutiny?
But Jonas Salk gets a parade down the main streets of New York when he develops a vaccine. I'm just happy when a week goes by and I don't get hate mail. No, things have changed.
The question implies that there's an imbalance, there's an asymmetry between between those people who get labeled as shills and the environmentalists or other groups that get a pass on their work, scientists. And I think this is a problem that I'm aware of. There are people who can be funded by agencies such as NIEHS, to do, for example, I think it's the figure is that NIEHS, National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences in the U.S., has spent somewhere around $170 million to fund research on BPA. BPA, as many of you know, has been judged by agencies, including the U.S. FDA and the EPA and the European Food Safety Agency, as being no problem to adults or to infants at the levels encountered in the environment. Nevertheless, and these reports have been issued and reissued, updated over the past 7 years or something, and in spite of this, you have this plethora of research that in cells and in gene expression and so forth and so on, and theoretical papers arguing that there's a non-monotonic dose-response relationship, and this explains how you don't get effects at high levels, but you get effects at levels that are vanishingly low. And there are other examples of this. And so if you have the if you espouse apple pie and motherhood and apple pie and you are in favor of the environment and you're studying something which on the face of it can sound plausible, you escape this kind of critical scrutiny. So it's another part of the problem.
How do you explain the distrust that has developed for FDA, Health Canada, EPA among the public?
I blame the S-bombs. No, and I'm quite honest with you. I mean, it became very popular about 10, 15, maybe 20 years ago now. I guess S-bombs have been a while. It became very popular to see the government and large institutions as people who are out to get you. You know, it makes for a good story, it makes for a great TV show or movie, and it became ingrained in the public consciousness. The public actually, because the public has become so separated from their food, so separated from the science, so separated from everything else, they don't actually see how it's made, and they become distrustful of it. That's why people love going to farmers markets, because they get to see the food in front of them. They enjoy that tactile experience of going back to their roots. Of course, it absolutely makes no sense, but we become very distrustful of huge associations because we don't see how they function anymore. People are afraid of what they don't understand and what they're not able to see. And I don't really know how we fix that except by becoming more open and doing stuff like this where we actually explain to people how vaccines work. When you actually explain to somebody how vaccines work, they start to realize, it's like, oh yeah, there's really no way this could really harm me unless I happen to have a specific allergy to one of the components. But, oh yeah, I guess a vaccine won't weaken my immune system. It's going to make my immune system stronger. Once you explain the mechanism, people understand that you take away the fear.
Ken?
But I think in some cases, industry is out to get us. When the cost of a single pill goes from $20 to $1,000 overnight, inexplicably, there's a problem. And I think with these kind of egregious abuses, it's understandable that people might be concerned about the ethical probity of industry.
Well, of industry, yeah. But why of government regulatory organizations? Like here, I mean, we have a real dichotomy with Health Canada where the pesticide management regulatory side of it is suspect. The drug regulations are suspect, because they're all in the pockets of big agro and big pharma. On the other hand, the Natural Products Health Directorate is angelic. And, you know, when they confer their natural product number on a product, which is totally meaningless because they require no evidence to do this, that's fine.
I agree with you, except because I'm older, I'm going to pick a different flex point. I think the flex point, at least in America, for sort of cynicism was Watergate. Suddenly there are these tapes about these people who are acting behind your back and not to your interests. And so it was just this birth of fear. And I'll give you an example. And I wrote a book about something called the Qatar incident, which was a polio vaccine that was made by Qatar Laboratories in 1955 that was made badly. I mean, it's so badly that 120,000 children were inadvertently inoculated with what was thought to be a polio vaccine, but was in fact live poliovirus. And so 120,000 got inoculated with 40,000 developed short-lived polio, 200 were permanently paralyzed, and 10 were killed. You should read the way that the jurors discussed that case after the sort of post-exit interviews. They wanted to find Qatar innocent. It was sort of, they were essentially forced to find him guilty because they couldn't believe that anybody would act egregiously knowing that this was a problem. I mean, I think today were that incident to happen, the CEO would be publicly flogged or hung. So it's a much more cynical, much more litigious, much more distrustful time than it used to be, say, 50 years ago. I'm not sure what the flex point was. Maybe it was the X-Files, but at least in the United States, I think it was Watergate. It made us cynical.
I think it's a more cynical time, but I also think that science has oversold. There's a lot of hype. The whole war on cancer, we were going to cure everybody of cancer magically, and it was never that simple. And I think science did itself a great disservice by overselling, and, you know, we promise a new miracle cure every week. And it's not just the natural health people who do it. It's every, you know, every mainstream university does it because they want to be in the headlines and they want to get donors. And so I think some of it has been brought upon science itself by overselling and overpromising. And that lends itself to cynicism, and it lends it to the public seeking out these magical solutions.
I think what Joe's point that, you know, why to say the groups of the natural news people all sort of stay under this Teflon and umbrella is because they're seen as outside of that. That alone is why they get the free pass. But I think you're right. I think we suffer from a certain level of hubris, and I think cancer is a perfect example, right? I mean, I think we've crossed the line with regard to our ability to prevent, say, thyroid cancer or even some breast cancer, certainly prostate cancer. We oversold that, I think, in terms of, you know, PSAs and biopsies, et cetera, and now we're backing off because we're doing more harm than good.
And if you're doing more harm than good, why not buy the pomegranate juice, you know?
Right.
And there have also been well-publicized cases of medical school professors in egregious conflict of interest situations. I could name a few. And I think the activists have realized that attacking this kind of abuse, whether it's real or a plausible abuse, is an effective strategy. And so they're now all looking for conflict of interest, and whether there are any or not. And this is just the way they think that they can move ahead politically.
Well, I think it's also true that the activists get a free pass when they accuse people of having these conflicts of interest and all this kind of stuff. Nobody's perfect, but many of the activists and the so-called scientists who back them have their own conflicts of interest, which are quite serious. I mean, you're mentioning these supplements and these alternative medicines and so on. It's a huge industry. There's a lot of money to be made from that, and it's all nonsense, but there's a financial interest there. But people don't seem to take that into account. Like, it's just all one-sided. The mainstream scientists are in the pocket of industry, and the other guys are like just in it for the good of humanity.
When people ask me, how can you distinguish good websites from bad websites regarding vaccines, I say the same thing every time. The good websites aren't selling anything. Look at the other websites. They're selling cures for autism and all these nutraceuticals, or, you know, directing you to personal injury lawyers who can help you sue pharmaceutical companies, always selling something. Mm-hmm.
We often think that these natural groups are sort of outsiders, they're fringe. They are not. They are very well funded and very well organized. We passed a new law in Canada, I think at the beginning of this year, or maybe at the end of last year, about drug safety, which is a good law. It's about tightening the controls about how drugs are tightening the process of drug surveillance, about prescription drugs. But it specifically exempts naturopathic medication and homeopathic medication and all these things. And that's because when the current government tried to pass an earlier version of this law a few years ago, which was supposed to encompass everything, the natural product lobby just went to town on the government and lobbied them so hard and made it known to them that they would never get this law passed unless they put that specific exemption in. And they put in a lot of money, and there was... A friend of mine was telling me this. I haven't checked it out on my first, but they said outside of Ottawa, right in front of the Parliament building, they had a giant billboard that said, thank you, Government of Canada, for exempting natural health products. 75% of all Canadians love using their vitamins, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. They are very well organized, and so it's a danger to underestimate them because they have a mission. They have a job. They make money when they sell you a product, and we have to remember that they are a lobby group like any other lobby group, and so sometimes we have to fight, you know, fire with fire in this case.
Okay, now let's pass on to whether or not there is something to be concerned about with these issues. So, obviously, GMOs, electromagnetic radiation, they're controversial, right? Vaccination is controversial. So, the question is, what is the risk-benefit analysis of these? Because I don't think that any scientist ever says no risk. It's only the activists who say that we say that, but we never say that. So how about hearing from the experts in this field of where you think there are some real issues? So maybe start with Jeff.
The issue that I feel confident addressing is EMF, and I address that as an epidemiologist. And tomorrow night I'm going to speak about what evidence do we have, what different kinds of evidence, and what is it What does it show? How does it stack up? So I think this is something that has been studied. If you think back to extremely low frequency electromagnetic fields as well as RF radio frequency, we've been studying these things going back for more than 30 years, and we know quite a bit about it. And one of the things that I didn't realize when I first got into learning about this is that different frequency radiation is used in bone healing and in cancer treatment and so forth, and microwaves. And so an enormous amount is known about these types of non-ionizing radiation. And it's not some mystery, although you can't see it, and it has no effects that we know, no solid effects that we know of beyond the effect of heating in the case of microwaves. So I think it's not something tangible, and the word radiation is involved, so people aren't going to understand the distance that separates UV or cosmic rays or X-rays from radio waves and microwaves. They're not going to understand the number of orders of magnitude and how useful these things are and how implausible it is. But I think that we have a huge amount of evidence of different kinds, and when you look against the background of the totality of the evidence, you see that people are reacting to little blips and to a study here, a study there, about which there are questions or about which there's absolutely no surprise that studies of the blood-brain barrier following exposure to microwaves or something in model systems, that some of the times they're going to come up with positive results. And one isn't going to know, well, what is the relevance of this result in this individual study that gets seized on? What is the relevance to the human situation, to real people going about their lives? And so I think that that this is, can't rule out that there is some, we were talking about this earlier, you can't rule out that there might not be some subtle, exquisitely subtle mechanism by which they could have some interaction with biology. But beyond that, I think we should convey to people that they should be worrying about other things.
Yet Consumers Reports, which is a respected publication this month, has an article on
Lauren just pointed it out to me. I haven't read it.
Yeah, where they actually say, don't put your cell phone in your pocket, don't put it in your breast pocket.
Well, I could make a comment about that, but and this is one of these areas where you know, the work of Johnny Ioannidis, who I mentioned earlier, that's public, who mentioned that 90% of what gets published in science journals turns out to be wrong. There's a large number of studies looking at the effects of cell phone radiation on cell cultures and all this kind of stuff, and quite a few of them find effects, and but none of them bear up under repetition, which is the thing that Paul mentioned earlier. And electromagnetic radiation is one of those things that scientists, physicists understand extremely well. Ken Foster has done work on this as well. Theoretically speaking, there's no mechanism anybody's come up with after 50 years of thinking about it, how this could have any effect whatsoever other than heating on tissues. And yet you have all these these papers that get getting published that are almost certainly all wrong. And I think it's one of these things that's a bit shocking, actually, that this kind of thing continues, but the public continues to believe it, so it keeps fueling it.
Mike, yep. I've been in this school since 1971, in one way or another. My wife says I was smarter about curing cancer instead of curing cell phones, but that's a different issue. And ever since then, the rhetoric has been the same. Concerned citizens would put together lists of reported effects of electromagnetic fields of whatever type and whatever intensity, and say there must be something going on. And health agencies would put together exhaustive reviews and not find any clear evidence of a problem, and say that more research is needed. And nothing has changed since the 70s in this. The topics of technology changed. So I think basically the problem here is that there's probably nothing there, but the literature is so prone to cherry picking that anyone who wants to be concerned about this issue can easily find enough evidence to convince them the world is coming to an end. And that's probably true, maybe to a lesser extent, in these other areas because the amount of literature is small. So we're basically looking at a fact of human existence, that there are no certainties in life, and people who are inclined to worry about something can easily find some kind of evidence to justify any kind of fears at all.
So regarding vaccines, the question about whether or not vaccines can cause serious or permanent harm, the answer is yes. The oral polio vaccine could itself cause polio. It was rare, caused it in about roughly one per 2.4 million doses, but it was real. That's why we moved away from the oral polio vaccine to the inactivated vaccine. The yellow fever vaccine, which was first introduced in the 1930s, has probably caused 50 or 55 deaths, primarily in people over 65 years of age, from systemic disease. The measles-containing vaccine can cause a lowering of the platelet count, cause thrombocytopenia. It's maybe one in 30,000 cases. It's not a serious side effect because it's transient, but it's real. That vaccine, the pandemic strain that was used in Scandinavian European countries, you know, the squalene adjuvanted influenza vaccine, probably was a real cause of narcolepsy, which is a disorder of wakefulness. And then, as was mentioned earlier, you know, vaccines contain gelatin, which at least a couple of vaccines contain gelatin, which can cause a severe type 1 hypersensitivity reaction. So like all medicines, anything that has a positive effect, vaccines can have a negative effect. I mean, our definition of safety is not one of absolute safety. We're not lawyers. I mean, we're doctors. So the definition is one of the benefits have to clearly and definitively outweigh the risk, which is true for vaccines, assuming there's not a medical contraindication. So the thing that's amazing to me is that the anti-vaccine groups never talk about these. They never talk about the real side effects of vaccines. It's vaccines cause autism or diabetes or multiple sclerosis or attention deficit disorder. They're like never right. I just wish they'd start picking sporting events, you know, so you could know who not to bet on. But
I think the problem is that when we talk about these issues, we talk, could there potentially be a risk? And like in many cases, yes, there could be a potential risk, but the risk would actually be very, very tiny. And we don't sort of explain to people that if you're really worried about X, Y, or Z, there are much more important things you have to be worried about. I was at a party the other day, and a friend of mine was complaining that there weren't any diet sodas, and they had to drink a real soda. I sort of explained to him, I was like, well, you know, there's really not much difference between the two. If you really want to lose weight, drink water. Whether you have diet soda or regular soda, you're probably not going to lose any weight based on, you know, a lot of the research. And as we're sitting here and debating the point, he takes out a cigarette and starts smoking. and yet if I were to beat some sense into him, I would be the criminal. It's actually very surprising. People tend to focus on these very sort of minute potential risks and ignore sort of the very big things. And, you know, if we could get people to stop smoking and exercise regularly, we'd actually probably do a lot more for people's overall health than, you know, worrying about the potential effects of our cell phones, which, quite frankly, are probably not causing us any real troubles.
But Paul, even if the autism thing were true, so what? I mean, the benefits would still dramatically outweigh the risks, no?
Well, if you were arguing that vaccines were causing autism in as many as 1 in 88 children in the United States, no. I would say that you would have to seriously consider it. But no, I think that vaccines are remarkably safe. I mean, they're held also to a level of safety beyond certainly any drug in our country. I mean, we have the so-called vaccine safety data link. When a vaccine is introduced into the country, you very quickly will know whether it has not just an uncommon side effect. You'll know very quickly whether it has a rare side effect. I mean, Maurice Hilleman, who I think is the father of modern vaccines, said, "I never breathe a sigh of relief until the first 3 million doses are out there." I think that's always going to be true, but if we had a drug safety data link, I think we probably would have figured out that Vioxx was a very rare cause of heart attacks much earlier. Now, vaccines don't cause autism. I don't know if that's on these films at all. Not true, okay?
One data point.
There's so much to syndrome, this fascinating syndrome of the one data point, I call it, where you read something and then it becomes the law, it gets spread, and we run with this even though there is a mountain of evidence to discredit that one data point. But it's when it touches the emotions, and I think in terms of food, in terms of what we eat, and how it, when it touches our health, it's a little, not as bad. But we see it on climate change as well. Well, clearly last winter was really cold, so who's telling me the Earth was warming up? Trust me, all the data says so for the last 15 years. But the data goes like this, and that's another thing to grab. But the one data point is people will grab, and again, how do you make sure that they look for a second and third opinion? They when you look at antibiotics versus vaccines, in the U.S. where I lived for 20 years, if your child is sick, there is a very high chance that no matter what he has, you will be prescribed antibiotics by the doctor that you see, and I'm not going to go any further. That was my experience in Texas. And then sometimes I would ask the dreadful question, well, does he really have a bacterial infection? And they say, well, does he have a confirmed bacterial infection? Should I give him really the antibiotics? Does he really need it? But people will give the antibiotics, and there are side effects to antibiotics as well.
Altering the microbiome
much
is
more,
probably the biggest, right?
We are very picky when it touches, and maybe the trick is to figure out what is it sociologically that makes us run with one but not with the other.
I read somewhere that moon landing was a fake. Is that true?
That one comes back a lot. There's that one. There's the Are We Alone, which we investigated last year with the Trottier Symposium. That one. So the conspiracy theory is very well.
How did they fake your space flight?
They're very good at it.
Recorder, yeah.
But the idea that the conspiracy is there, we are being hidden something. That people would come and ask me the question, well, I know you can't tell me, but I'm sure NASA is hiding something about Roswell. And I'm like, well, look at the question. If they're hiding something, and I would tell you then, it's not logical. Use your hand.
You know, I often ask myself, because, you know, people who come into the office, you know, in the emergency, for example, with a young child with a cold or, you know, a potential bacterial infection, and I look in their history, and they haven't been vaccinated. And I think to myself, you know, vaccines are literally the largest clinical trial ever done. I mean, it's, you know, the most people in the world, you know, have vaccines versus antibiotics. And I think to myself, why do you trust me for antibiotics and not vaccines? Right? I mean, antibiotics truly have research backing, but compared to what vaccines have, it's not even comparable. Right? So for me, I don't understand why a parent or a patient would trust me for X but not for Y. It's very complicated for me.
It's very simple. You're not Jenny McCarthy.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think we as scientists or communicator have to be very careful how we deal with this question of risk. We say the risk is very, very small, 1 in 10,000. But just it's enough if you show a kid that has gotten the reaction, has gotten infected because of the vaccine, that kills completely that notion that it's extremely rare. So we have to be very careful when we talk about this, and we're not talking just numbers, because then we're scientists, we don't care really.
People have any concept of risk. You can say something causes a problem in 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 14 million. I think it's processed as one. I mean, the New York State Lottery is able to sell a lot of tickets with the phrase "it could happen to you," and I think that's how people see it. Mm. They don't distinguish numbers at all.
So, Kevin, what are the real risks with GMOs?
Yeah, that's really a great question, because there are risks, and most of them were predicted. And most of them have played out exactly as predicted. And really the main one is that when you're using what we think about as kind of silver bullet modalities, so the two major traits are herbicide resistance and insect resistance. Yet when you use exclusively these two major mechanisms, because for various reasons, you can predict that they're going to break down, just like antibiotic resistance develops as bacteria find their way around, evolve their way around our medications. Insects will find their way around an insect control that's installed in the plant. Or weeds will find their way around an herbicide, which does not kill the plant, but does not kill the crop, but kills the weeds. And all of these were anticipated and expected. And now we're seeing resistance in a very real way. Part of the problem has been the lack of research into alternative mechanisms that would allow a farmer to alternate mechanisms year to year. And that's because of the arduous deregulation process and a lot of the expense of deregulating a new crop. The other big question is much more of a social one, and it has to do with farmer against farmer. When some farmers say, we don't want contamination, and what they mean by that is that they grow a crop that they feel is, or they can show evidence of, pollen drift from, say, a GM crop across the street into a non-GM crop. And it requires more interaction between farmers to understand when they're planting and when those things will be flowering, when those crops will be flowering, more better coordination. But I do understand those concerns, because when you have a market that demands that this not test positive for transgenic crops or genetically engineered crops, then that's something that I feel that we have to think about and at least try to respect. The other big issue is the unavailability of non-genetically engineered seeds. So if you want to, so they work so well in so many cases that if you're a cotton farmer or even a field corn farmer, you have a hard time sometimes finding non-GE seeds. So if you're trying to sell to a different market because of a premium price maybe, you can't do it. But when I think about the risks of a technology, I don't want to just think about the risks that we've been able to predict and observe in terms of the deployment of the technology. I think we also have to consider the risks of not deploying the technology. And today, 20,000 people will die on this planet because of lack of a few critical micronutrients. And we could solve those problems. We have those technologies. Those plants exist to sequester iron or to sequester or to accumulate beta carotene in things like cassava, bananas, and rice. It's already been done. It's just the opposition to the deployment of those technologies that's the problem. And along that same line, we can put out plants that will grow in challenging conditions, that resist drought, floods, heat, cold. Those plants exist. There are probably a dozen different crops within 3 kilometers of where we're sitting that are sitting in laboratory shelves that will never be deployed commercially that could solve problems for somebody in need. In my state, which is a very fragile state, we're suffering from a citrus disease that's destroying our citrus industry. This may be the last year you get a Florida orange. We have a genetically engineered solution, but it can't be deployed because of the pushback from the public as well as the arduous regulatory process. So everything comes with risks and benefits. But I think as scientists, it's most important for us to start communicating to the public that this isn't just about first world problems that we predicted and can control. This is about how the lack of responding to a crisis in other places has to be considered as part of this equation.
Brian. So one of my fears as a vaccine scientist, and I think this is probably true for the others as well, is that the one data point proves a whole class is bad. So if there's a single GMO product that actually results in serious problems, that will damn the entire field.
Yes.
And right now, vaccine science is entering into a really interesting era because we actually have the technologies to address things that we've never thought of using vaccines for before, cancer, autoimmune disease. Just as a simple example, the melanoma vaccines that are being introduced now, these are horrible skin disease. And one of the side effects of an effective vaccine is that the people who are developing an immune response that will kill the tumor actually get vitiligo. They get areas where the immune cells actually attack the regular melanocytes in the skin, and you end up with white patches. I think most people with melanoma who would normally die within 6 months would welcome the white patches as a sign that the vaccine was working. But all you have to do is take that cancer now, put it inside the head, and have a vaccine for a glioma that would very likely kill some people while it saves others. And the people with the gliomas and no other option would clearly take the chance for a cure, an immunologic cure, and yet it's all the same word. It's a vaccine. And when people read the newspaper that says new glioma vaccine associated with brain death, the only thing they'll remember the following day is the word vaccine and death. And I think that this sort of the one data point gets spread, and that's potentially quite damaging for vaccine science, probably GMO science, radiation science as well.
I would come back to something Dr. Offit said I think was important about what does risk mean in our modern society? And I think that's changed. I think traditionally risk was there's a hazard, there's something bad that can happen. And I think now risk is something different. It's this potential hazard plus outrage. And we have all this outrage in society, and it's really easy to get people scared, and it's almost impossible to get them unscared. So it's not a level playing field in any way. And I don't know how we counter that. I think a good part of the public is fairly rational, even if they don't understand the math. But there's a very loud minority that does a pretty good job of scaring the bejesus out of everyone. And I don't know how you counter that. I think they've always been there in society, but now they have the internet. And it's changed things.
Ariel.
Well, about 20 years ago, already the World Health Organization had put out a statement saying that the major problem with GMOs is that it's developed for large industrial agriculture and not for the small farmer or not for the niche problem. And I think really you mentioned all these things that GMOs could do, and I mentioned that we always say that, you know, beta-carotene and all that, but it's not being developed. It's not being developed because, you know, it takes money to develop this thing, and it's only for the large industrial agricultural outfit that it's developed. And I don't know how one can deal with it, because that, I think, has played very detrimentally to GMOs, to the whole concept.
Okay.
I'd like to get back to the area of professional competence. Canada has provincial regulation over the health services, not the drugs, but health services. And various, like I live in Ontario, and they just legitimized homeopathy and naturopathy, and now is growing out of the dark ages of 1923, and now they've got new legislation. And the source for misinformation is so bad in these industries, and yes, they have their own magazines and journals, and they have their own meetings. And one of my best friends is a chiropractor, so he knows my interest in chiropractic quackery. But how do you legislate a unique part of the legislation that goes from one regulated health profession in one province to where it's not even regulated, like in Quebec? You still don't have a regulation of homeopaths and naturopaths in a place like Quebec. So they can do anything they want. There's no government action against their claims. And if you want anti-vaccine people there, they're number one and two.
Chris?
I think the problem is that we have to remember the government's main objective is to get elected. Now, maybe I'm a bit cynical, but this is what I saw when I was researching the story I was writing about how Health Canada regulates its natural health products. The government's decision to exempt them was based purely for political reasons and as a consequence of lobbying. And so the decision to regulate and not regulate various groups is really based on political decisions. In many cases, it's not based on science. I think if the government asked any, you know, expert in science or medicine, they would tell them that there's no basis for homeopathy. To justify it, to legitimize it, to fund it in any way is ridiculous. And yet they do it because they know they will lose votes. If they were to go against homeopathy, they would lose votes and probably not gain any votes. Because the people who are scientifically minded are probably not going to see this as a major issue that would, you know, make them change their political affiliation. But the small core group of people who make their living off of this would try to fight the government. And so I don't think we can wait for the government to do our work for us, because they won't. They have a different agenda. The way we combat quackery is doing stuff a lot of us do, which is getting out into the public sphere. And the minute we can go mainstream, the minute you have people like on ABC, Jimmy Kimmel, make fun of the anti-vaccine movement, make fun of gluten people, that's how you reach the tipping point and you get society to realize, okay, well, I guess there really is nothing here. So I think we just have to keep raising the awareness until people realize, until people start making fun of homeopathy to say, like, what do you mean there's nothing in the product? This makes absolutely no sense. So I don't think government regulation is really the answer.
Can you legitimately regulate it if it's quackery?
I don't think you should. And I think I don't think the government should be, because I think I don't understand what they're actually saying. If we accept the scientific premise that there is nothing in homeopathic medication, that you're selling each other water, how can the government create an association or a college of homeopathy to register people to sell you water, which should be coming for free out of the faucet anyways? Like, it fundamentally doesn't make sense. And if you think about it, it doesn't make sense. And it's being done simply because the government is trying to hedge off accusations or lobbying efforts by these groups. And that's as far as I know, the only reason that provincial governments are doing this across the country.
No, the idea of gaining votes, and that's all they care about. I mean, isn't that why the two doctors didn't refute Trump?
Yeah. Carson, that was your whole point. Why that was more disingenuous than Trump saying, like, vaccines lead to autism, perhaps. But
I mean, Trump can say it out of ignorance.
Right, but Carson, like, who actually knows better, is trying to get votes
I'm not so sure what Ben Carson knows. He's a neurosurgeon.
Pediatric.
That's the old line, right? When the elevator's closing, what does the surgeon put in there to make sure that he doesn't get it? He puts in his head, right?
I would say there's definitely the aspect of what the information is out there. But then there's also the groundswell of people. People feel good about this. Again, I'm back to sociology, because I don't understand why is it that we still today have every single major newspaper having an horoscope page. Mm-hmm. And if you Google horoscope on your web, you will have pages and pages and pages of horoscope until you hit one article that will say, oh, by the way, this is a complete scam.
I mean, you can't break down mankind into 12 different groups?
There's actually 13, but that, we don't go there.
Don't how go much there. Attention we pay.
It's an amazing thing about what people feel good. You know what? There's a bit of that maybe going on. You know, it's not hurting them to read the horoscope, right?
That's our number one clicked on article every day. That's why it's there. And what is the harm?
No, so what's the harm of the naturopath who, say, listens in? I know. I'm not saying the question.
No.
I'm just saying there is also the groundswell of, indeed, there's not only the people who want to gain votes, it's those that vote with their one data point. They have a sister-in-law that used that mixture that was prescribed from her naturalist whatever, and it worked. So she's doing it too. She feels better.
But I think there is a legitimate dilemma for governments as well with things like homeopathy. Do you regulate it and try and protect the public to a certain degree and give it some credibility in passing? Or do you just allow this Wild West and you don't protect the public and then something happens and then you get blamed for it? Oh, why didn't you do something about homeopathy? Somebody died. I think they're in a pickle. I don't see how governments... I think that's why we have a mixture of regulation and non-regulation. They just don't know what to do.
I think it's easy to say that there's probably very little harm to something. If you're going to a naturopath and all they were telling you was eat your fruits and vegetables and exercise regularly, then fine. You're wasting your money to be told something your mother was telling you every day when you were growing up. That's just a waste of time and a waste of money. And you can argue that in a free society, people are allowed to waste their money for whatever they want. The problem becomes is when these naturopaths and these homeopaths start going beyond what their training allows, and they start telling people, like, no, you don't need vaccinations, take this NoSode, which was approved by Health Canada until very recently. When you have these naturopaths claiming, like, I can give you IV vitamins, and, you know, you don't have to go for your cancer therapy because IV vitamin C will cure lung cancer. Of course, there's trials on this. And I think that the danger with legitimizing them is that it sort of emboldens them to sort of make increasingly more ambitious claims. And when you say, I'm a licensed naturopath, well, people say, well, I guess that means something, right? They're licensed by the government, they have a big clinic, and they're giving me IV vitamin C, and vitamins, I guess, are good for me, so let me go do that. I mean, I don't think we gain anything by regulating them, because, well, there was that documentary from the CBC a little while back, even though NOSOLs are no longer allowed, you can't market and say that a homeopathic medication can be used as alternative to vaccine. The homeopaths are saying it all over the place because you can't regulate what's going on in offices. So I don't think we gain anything by the regulation. I think we only lose because we legitimize something that is at best a waste of time and money, and at worst, you know, turning people away from valid medical therapies that could make them sick. This is why we had a measles epidemic.
Okay, we don't have that much time left. I thought we would give a chance to some of our observers, if they have any questions to ask. Anybody out there have a question to ask or a comment to offer?
You know me?
Yes.
Well, I could have been kind of looking at the same thing when SARS happened, that how many people were flogging various medications that had no backing, and what was the impetus for that? And they're taking advantage. They're in the newspapers. They're advertising. Do people have any comments about that? Because that was certainly happening.
For SARS?
Yeah, for SARS.
What happened?
SARS happened in Toronto. And in the newspapers, people were making all kinds of claims for chemical concoctions that would do something, and they were hot air. You know, why? How did that come up in a game? Is it a case that you can't regulate that and it just comes out, and it comes out during crisis?
On my website, I often follow or point people to places like Sierra Leone, Nigeria, Kenya, Zimbabwe, where they're, even the government is supporting herbal remedies for HIV. Every month there's another country that just embraces this technology. I was in Florida when SARS hit for about a week, and I got taken to the hospital. I became a diabetic. And the doctor on staff at the Cleveland Clinic did not want to touch me because he thought I had SARS because I flew from the Toronto airport in the beginning of the thing. So.
Okay, if there's no other questions.
There's a question over here.
Yeah.
I'm
sorry. I have a bit of a cold right now, but maybe vitamin C, but I live with dementia and Alzheimer's elders. I find there's a bit of contradiction with, you know, you push a lot for drugs and the vaccination. Like cervical vaccination for teenagers, I don't know. But when it comes to 90 years old, the medication, the pills are so big, and they have to swallow like probably 12, 20. Wouldn't it be better just something more natural or let it be? I find the pharmaceutical companies are making a fortune. My grandparents never took that. It was very difficult to find Tylenol or aspirin. Getting older and to live forever, I don't believe in that. So I do think there's something about ethic control and more moderation when it comes to pushing medication, pills, and I believe in research, but anyway, that's my opinion.
Well, the pill pushers are not only the pharmaceutical companies, the natural product pill pushers are out there as well in droves.
First of all, on our formulary at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, I would say 70% of the products of the drugs on our formulary are derived from plants. I mean, they're all natural products. I mean, vaccines are natural. They're made from natural substances. I never quite understood the dichotomy between natural and other. I mean, you know, Mother Nature can kill you and does. That's why we fight back.
Also, the point is, you know, you raise a valid point. As people are living longer, what are the goals of medical therapy now? And you can make an argument that if you're 90, trying to reduce your 10-year risk of having a heart attack may not be a fruitful endeavor. So, you know, you do make a point that, you know, maybe we have to reassess the medications we give to, you know, elderly patients because they may not be useful anymore. But, you know, I think to your comment where you're like, well, you know, my parents never took medication. You have to remember, the fact that we have 90-year-olds now is because of the victory of medical science. We live longer now than we have ever lived in the past. Life expectancy has been going consistently upwards, and it's because of these medical therapies. So geriatrics is a very important field and often a underappreciated field in medical research, and we do have to see what medications are effective in our geriatric populations and at what point can we actually stop certain medications. But I think overall, medical therapy is good for you because it's keeping us alive. It's letting us live longer.
Your mind is no longer there. Mm-hmm. And families, yeah, they require more assistance.
Yeah.
There are just zombies, no memory. Where's the dignity when you pump like so much medication to live forever and you're lying in the super hospitals and there's hardly any visits because, and the nurses, or nurse, female, a male, nurses and the doctors, I admire the doctors, but it's like with the technology today, all the results of testing takes time. And I mean, it's a sad situation we're living now, to live forever and you keep the mind totally nul. No, you're positive.
Well, this could be another total separate discussion, because there's, you know, so many points raised there. Maybe we'll consider that for next year. Anyway, maybe just one very quick last point, the precautionary principle. The idea that if there's any possible risk with anything, you shouldn't do it. And this is something that is being pushed in Europe, much less so here.
I don't think there is any precautionary principle. It's so ambiguous in its definition that it could be, means almost anything you say it is. The entire European regulation of environment and health is based on the precautionary principle because that's written into the Maastricht Treaty. And on the whole, Europe is roughly as precautionary on many issues as the United States and Canada, even though they make all their regulations explicitly based on the precautionary principle. What the problem is if you're trying to develop arbitrary guidelines or arbitrary rules to protect against imaginary hazards. Mm-hmm. But that's an inappropriate application of regulation. It's not the precautionary principle itself. Canada uses the precautionary principle in its Safety Code 6 for electromagnetic fields. They say that Health Canada says that explicitly on its website. And its regulations are very similar to those in the United States, for which the precautionary principle is not regulated. So I think you've got to be a little careful what you mean by precautionary principle, given the fact that it's such a flexible and poorly defined concept. So I'm attacking the question, not providing an answer.
I think the whole notion is a little bit flawed because there, as we've all said it sort of several times already today, is that there are risks to everything. I mean, there is, you know, one in a million risk. You could theoretically have an allergic reaction to any molecule in the environment. So to say that something has to be risk-free is ludicrous because there's just no rationale to it whatsoever. So I think what we have to look at is more the terms of meaningful risks. What are the absolute risks associated with this? And fundamentally, do the benefits outweigh the risks? The best example I can give is during the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s when these new medications came out and nobody really knew what the side effects were going to be. But they were approved and given out to patients because this was a lethal disease for which there were really no alternatives at that point. So where the line is going to change from case to case. And when there are no alternatives and there's a lot of risk to the disease, you might be willing to tolerate certain side effects. Whereas if it's a relatively benign condition for which there are alternatives, you probably are going to be a lot more stringent and say, you know, the side effect profile has to be very, very low before we'll approve this medication. So I think the line shifts with
every
situation.
But in Europe, mostly the precautionary principles apply to non-essential methods and chemicals.
It's applied to everything.
You know, pardon?
It's applied to everything. Because by statute, it's the basis of the regulation.
Yeah, but the concept that we have of precautionary principle is that if there's a chance that it's going to do harm, don't do it. But we're thinking about things that you could do without, right? Like bisphenol A would be a classic example. I mean, you know, if there is some risk, even if it's not proven, I mean, we can live without BPA.
But Safety Code 6 is based on the precautionary principle. Canada has already adopted it.
Well, it certainly hasn't adopted it in
that's what
chemicals.
The website of Health Canada says. It uses the precautionary principle to regulate electromagnetic fields.
It might be on their website, but they may not actually be using it in practice.
Okay.
You know, just my problem with the precautionary principle is that, by definition, it means that you exercise caution with an understanding that in the exercising of caution that you're not doing harm. The problem is that that's occasionally not true. I mean, in the world of vaccines, that wasn't true. When thimerosal, the ethylmercury-containing preservative that was in a number of vaccines given to children late 90s, early 2000, was essentially precipitously removed from vaccines in the name of caution. I mean, what's the harm, right, of taking thimerosal out of single-dose vials where you really don't need a preservative? That was the thinking. But the fact of the matter is we gave that product a scarlet letter. As a consequence, there were a number of neonatal nurseries that didn't give a thimerosal-containing hepatitis B vaccine because they were afraid they were going to be doing harm, and children died of hepatitis B. And so that was, in the name of precaution, we actually did harm. So I guess my argument would be, right, taking a plasticizer out of a child's toy is not going to do harm, but this did do harm, and so therefore it wasn't a precautionary principle.
But that's arbitrary.
But that's the big issue with food, is we have well-fed, affluent folks in the West deciding the level of risk that's acceptable for people who have nothing, who could benefit from improved crops and the nutrition that can come from them. And to me, that is the most egregious example of how this can do harm, is that we have the audacity to say that we think this is dangerous. Therefore, we are going to exercise our level of precaution to block the deployment of, let's just say, beta-carotene enriched bananas or beta-carotene enriched cassava or virus-resistant cassava, which is happening throughout the African continent. That's where that really hits home for me. You know, the people I want to serve, their level of precaution is much different than mine.
Really good example, Joe. Sorry.
Yeah.
That involves both environment and health was the global decision of wealthy people to stop the use of DDT.
Yeah.
In areas of intense malaria transmission. And basically we said you can no longer use DDT, which resulted in huge numbers of deaths. And then a reversal of that decision to allow indoor residual spraying still. But I think that the point that Paul makes is that many of these decisions are either, there's the potential for errors of both omission and commission. And if the consequences of omission are actually larger than the potential theoretical consequences of commission, then absolutely full speed ahead and introduce this product.
Again, going back to bisphenol A, this product has been used lining cans and used in to contain food and has prevented botulism. It's been in use for 60 years. And so you have to face the question of, well, what do you know about the products that are going to be substituted that are going to take the place of BPA? So you can so obviously it was removed from baby bottles and BPA-free was an advertising ploy. But there's a very real question of taking something which you have, and this applies to medications too, you have something that has a long track record and that you know something about and that there's extraordinary amount of data on, and you have to be cautious about what you're going to replace that with because you could do real harm.
I'm actually doing writing with the precautionary principle, and the single biggest topic of concern in literature is global warming, and Europe is proposing measures to address global warming as a precautionary measure. The point is not precautionary principle, but arbitrary and senseless applications of precaution, and that we could find good applications of precaution, such as wash your hands after handling raw chicken, and we could find ridiculous applications. So it's not precautionary principle itself, it's arbitrary and stupid regulations. And we certainly have no end of those.
Okay. Well, as we said at the beginning, it would be, yeah.
Since we have very little time, there are really the topic 7 and 8. I really would like to hear something about it. Whether should genetically modified food be labeled? This whole concept of labeling, I think, is really important, and we should just. I'd love to hear from the panel, and also the vaccination. Should it be made mandatory?
Okay, Kevin, in a couple minutes.
Okay, I'll hammer fast through this. The reasons why I'm not excited about labeling, and I'll start again with what a gentleman in Africa said to me when we had a discussion of labeling in the U.S., and he said, the arrogance of the United States to want to separate good food from perfectly good food with a box decoration when my people want food. And here in the state, or here in North America, I should say, it's a little different argument. We already have laws from the FDA that mandate that products containing hazardous, potentially hazardous materials be labeled, so that's already there. The products aren't hazardous. We have non-GMO and organic, which is already labeled, which is great for those industries, and people who want to make that choice can make that choice. There's the issue of activists have very clearly stated that labeling is the first step to a ban, that once we can identify it, we can scare people away from it. And the biggest problem that we discuss with politicians is who's going to pay for the level of infrastructure of government that now will have to monitor, test, and enforce that things that are labeled are appropriately labeled and the package contents are consistent. And the last point is, if we're in the States anyway, 50 different packages, 50 different supply chains, 50 different ways of sourcing food that vary with their exemptions and with their definitions in every state, it will make a definite increase in the cost of food and scarcity in some places that may not be able to afford that. So those are the reasons I'm opposed.
Can I ask just a quick question? I mean, the word's genetically modified, right? I mean, for me, how far back does this go? Because, I mean, what happens with cauliflower, right, which was wild mustard a couple hundred years ago, right? What happens with every – if you walk into a grocery store and you push a button and you go back a couple hundred years, right, you see gross carrots and you see horrific-looking corn and you see a wild mustard plant. There's nothing else, right? So, I mean, do you label those two? You know, would you label all the artificially selected products as well?
No. And that's the problem with the legislation is the words genetically modified don't mean anything in science.
Exactly.
We're talking about transgenic, or which moving the one gene or genetically engineered. The definitions of artificially doubled chromosomes came up in the Hawaii legislation. That means you now cannot grow a seedless watermelon on Maui legally. So the definitions are awful, and they're not written by scientists. They're written by attorneys and activists. And it's going to be a real problem going forward.
Okay. Brian, quickly. Does the state have the right to enforce vaccination children?
I think most states have the right to enforce public health measures when the public is endangered. So somebody with multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis can be restrained. I don't think that applies to vaccines, and I'm not in favor of compulsory vaccination. I think that it would be quite useful to have some level of coercion and make it quite difficult for people to refuse vaccines, and in particular to provide them with education during that process so that it's not a pure coercion, but it's an educational coercion.
Paul? I'll take a contrary view. In a better world, you shouldn't need vaccines to be mandated. I mean, Scandinavian countries, Hungary, do not have compulsory or mandatory vaccination, yet they have very high immunization rates because people in those countries actually think public health officials and doctors are actually acting in their best interests, crazy as that may sound. Mm-hmm. In this country, that's not true. In this country, there are a significant number of people who are choosing to delay or withhold or not vaccinate their children, and so there is harm. And to me, the reason that California now has overturned their philosophical exemption, so they only have a medical exemption to vaccination, is because of the way they actually did that campaign, which was brilliant. What they did was they had a girl who was 3 or 4 years old who had leukemia, and they said, what about her? I mean, she... If she's going to school and she needs to go to school, what about her? She's part of the herd. She depends on the herd to protect her. You have to protect her because when one chooses not to vaccinate their child, they're choosing to not only expose their child to harm, but also those with whom they come in contact with harm.
I mean, Rand Paul at the Republican National Debate said, you know, you don't, the government doesn't own your children. You own your children. You actually don't own your children. You have a certain, you own your car, but you don't own your child. You have a certain responsibility when you have a child. And that responsibility includes keeping them in the safest position possible, because it's understood when you're a child that the only people that are going to represent you are your parents. It's assumed your parents are representing your best interests, and that's not always true. And I think when it's not true, that's when the state can step in. I mean, I'm going to present this story tonight. Where we did have compulsory vaccination in our city, I think for the first time in the history of this country, we had compulsory vaccination. Children were forced to be vaccinated against their parents' will because it was that bad. And I don't think we should ever get to the point where it's that bad.
Just to make a point, when you're saying this country,
This is all North America. No, sorry, the United States of America. So that country, the one to the south, that little one to the south.
Okay, we're going to leave the last word to Jeffrey about what should education institutions do if a student claims that they are sensitive to Wi-Fi.
I think it's an opportunity to do some educating and to really explain what we know about these waves and this radiation, and to make the point that to give examples of to explain what this is. It's got nothing to do with X-rays, and to reassure them that this is in no way posing something to worry about.
But in the meantime, we have parents suing.
Really?
Yeah. Right. I see.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
It's a tough sell, no question about it.
Okay, well, we started out far-ranging, and I think we ended up far-ranging, but it's been an interesting discussion, and of course it promises to be even more interesting tonight. 5:30, we're going to examine vaccination, and tomorrow night, GMOs and cell phones. So thanks for all of you around the room who came to partake of this.
That's nice.
Thank you.